Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
On this episode of Most Notorious, America's first female serial killer, Jane Toppin.
Yeah, I think that she realized that it wasn't just the torture that she enjoyed, but actually taking life as well. Like, she liked being in control of people living and dying. That's why she liked to push them to almost death and then bring them back. But also deliberately taking someone's life evidently gave her some kind of thrill or satisfaction.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis. We are back again, together, to explore another historical murderer. So Mary Kay McBrayer joins me today. She is co-founder and co-host of a podcast called Everything Trying to Kill You, where she analyzes horror movies. And the book she is here to talk about today is called America's First Female Serial Killer, Jane Toppin and the Making of a Monster. Great to have you on. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here and to talk to you about our monster.
Yes, I'm excited too. So, what first turned you on to the subject of Jane Toppin?
So, Jane's story stands out to me for several reasons, but I like we were talking just before we started recording, and I love anything about gangsters. I love anything that's a good underdog story. I think I really appreciate, and that's what stood out to me the most about hearing about her, because I heard her story first on a podcast, which I'm sure your listeners will know, My Favorite Murder. And if you've heard the show, then you know it's mostly comedy and like some facts. But as they were telling the story, I just remember thinking, okay, but that can't be all there is to it. Because the very first part of her story is like, or the documented part, is that her father surrendered Jane and her sister to the Boston Female Asylum, which was essentially an orphanage. And then because he was a tailor and he lost his mind and tried to sew his eyelids shut. And I just remember thinking like, okay, well, anyone like that just that sequence of events alone is enough to traumatize someone forever. Like if you were old enough to remember, or even if you didn't remember it. And I just remember thinking like, I need to know more about all of her story, because she had so many odds set against her. And I also think it's interesting that like a lot of people have odds set against them and they don't kill 30 people. I mean, I just was really interested in the idea that, in her as a person, because she went through so much at such an interesting period in history, and that she didn't have to become this kind of monster. Like there was definitely some maybe not moment, but gradual escalation that led to her becoming this serial killer rather than, you know, a really successful person in another field. So I think that's what originally turned me on to her story.
So, yeah, you already talked a bit about her early life. I know there isn't a lot out there about it. What do we know about her first few years in the world?
You're exactly right. What we do know is based on very fragmented accounts from the orphanage mostly, and then a more fact-heavy book that I referenced a lot is by Harold Schechter, which I'm sure that all of your listeners know of him and are as obsessed with him as I am, because he just, he's the talking head, right, in every documentary. Like, he knows the most, and he just seems like the person that you would find at a cocktail party back when we could have cocktail parties, and you would just, you know, just want to hang like next to him to hear what he was talking about. So a lot of what we do know was found and compiled by him. And some of that is the record of her parents' immigration from Ireland. The number of siblings she had is not clear. Different records say 4 and 2. And then some of them list the same name for a child. So I feel like there's some sort of discrepancy there. We know that her mother died when Jane was very young of tuberculosis, and her father was a single father, and he was a tailor to 2 or 4 children at a really, you know, at the turn of the century, which was just a really rough time for everyone, but especially Irish immigrants, because they were blatantly discriminated against, like legally and individually. And we also know that she was, after she was at the Boston Female Asylum, she was an indentured servant, and that she was indentured out several years before the typical age when one would be indentured out. So basically, and I'm looking at it from a very business-like perspective, whoever indentured her got a lot more for their money than they would have otherwise. We also know she was a really precocious kid. So she was very smart, and it really was important to her that people liked her and wanted to be around her. So she was kind of awesome, like kind of the life of the party when she was a kid, but she would get in trouble for telling lies when really she was telling stories. But we also know that she was born Honora Kelly, which is like the most Irish name, and her foster family made her change her name to Jane and gave her their last name, but never adopted her. So it's like a series of cascading failures on behalf of the society that Jane lived in, where they just, you know, had opportunity after opportunity to let her shine and didn't. And I think that has a lot to do with, not everything, of course, to do with who she became, but I don't see how that could not be a part of it, if that makes sense.
It does, yeah. What was the family dynamic like in the Toppin household?
Oh, so pretty terrible. You had your matriarch, which was Mrs. Toppin, or as Jane was required to call her, Auntie. And then you had Elizabeth, who was treated as though she was about the same age as Jane and kind of looked like she was the same age as Jane. So she looked like, you know, 12, 14. But she was actually much older, like 15 years. I can't remember the exact age offhand, but like significantly older than Jane. But they were, but Elizabeth considered her a sister. That's the Elizabeth Toppin, and then Brigham after she married the deacon of the local church. And not very much is said about Mr. Toppin. So different records say that he either was, you know, working a lot or died before or shortly after Jane was indentured there. And they were a wealthy family, the Toppins. I mean, wealthy enough to afford to be able to support another person who was taking care of their house, another child. And Elizabeth was definitely the favored child, especially because they never formally adopted Jane, to the point that they, when she aged out, like, so her indenture ended, so she turned 18, and she just kind of got the money that she that Auntie promised the Boston Female Asylum she would give her and a new set of clothes. And she was like, okay, so you can stay here if you want, but you don't have to. I was like, well, what else am I going to do? Like, they didn't set her up to do anything else independently. Like, all she knew was domestic labor and stuff. And I just feel like, and based on research as well, and based on like personal experience, like that would not go over well with someone who worked their ass off all the time. I'm sorry, can I swear on this? I forgot to ask you that.
No one has ever asked me that before. Fire away.
Okay. Well, to someone who worked really hard and none of her merit was rewarded, that would just be really frustrating, especially when you were trying, like, these are the only people that you interact with on a regular basis. So they're the ones whose opinion you care about the most, you know? And I can't imagine that not making someone resentful. Like, I know it takes a special person to forgive and to forgive people who don't want to be forgiven, but it makes me mad kind of thinking about it, you know, like especially then, I mean, we know now it's a little bit more nuanced than this, but America was supposed to be the place where you could come and get a fresh slate. And if you worked really hard, you did really well. And that's really not what happened here at all.
Right. So as you mentioned, Mrs. Toppin pays her off at the end of her indentured servitude term, tells her she can stay or she can go. What happens next? What does she do?
So she stays on for between 10 and 12 years, depending on the records, which is a long time. And even nowadays, starting a new career in your late 20s is kind of risky, like even now. And then, you know, the life expectancy was so much shorter than it is now. And she was a woman and she was working class, that like starting a new profession was very uncommon, but she did because she could. So, and this is another thing, like, speaking of the family dynamics you asked about before, not only did Auntie never adopt her, but she didn't leave her anything in her will, even though she was like all she knew of a mother. And then several years after that, after she continued to serve with the Brighams, which is her foster sister and Elizabeth's husband. So she decided after staying on with the Brighams for a while that she was going to nursing school, and she got accepted to two of the really prestigious nursing schools in the Boston, Massachusetts area. Cambridge and Massachusetts General, I believe, were the two. And I forgive me, I can't remember which one she went to first, but she did everything there except for graduate, essentially, and then decided to go to the other one. And then the same thing happened there. And then she went into private nursing, which is when our, you know, festivities sort of begin. But that's kind of the trajectory. It's like in her adulthood, really, she decided she wanted a career change. And I know that now we are finally appreciating nurses for the heroes that they are. They truly are just some of the like most overworked and underpaid and totally essential people in our culture. And then the patient load would have been much higher, and it would have been an equally dangerous job to have, because then it was like they barely knew they needed to wash their hands. Like, I know that we're reteaching a lot of people that they need to wash their hands, but then they were just kind of like, I don't understand why this person has hospitalism, which is what they basically called bacterial infections from not disinfecting their instruments, because they didn't know. So she would have had all of that, the health risks, had a ton of extra patients, and largely what she did was like custodial work. So on top of the nursing duty. So it was like a really hard job. I mean, you could make good money doing it, but it was long hours and hard work. And then she was like, well, I'm going to do private nursing then, because I can. Everyone loves me, which they did. All of the doctors were obsessed with her. I'm not in a gross way, but they were just like, no, put Jane on with me because she knows what she's doing. But her patients were scared of her, and they kept reporting her for good reason. And she's like, I'll just be a private nurse then. And she took all of her character references and would work kind of in homes with not exactly hospice care, but similar to that. Like when the elderly got sick, she would live and work in their homes, if that makes sense.
Sure.
So that was kind of the next step career-wise.
Right. Why were her patients frightened of her?
So in the hospital, she was overheard by several nurses saying, and this is actually documented, that the complaints are that there was no point in keeping elderly people alive. And so the nurses would overhear that, and her patients would overhear it. And that, I mean, they would report it because they were scared, and then, which is totally understandable and reasonable. And they also were afraid of her because, well, a lot of her patients died. And like, granted, based on the circumstances we were just talking about, a lot of patients died in hospitals for other reasons, but like a lot of hers died. And then I don't want to go into too much detail about Amelia Finney, but she's basically what, you know, sealed the case against Jane, because she was a surviving victim, which I think she may not have been the only one, but she was the only one that testified, which I just feel like is a big heroic move too, because this is like the Victorian era for someone it's hard enough now, right, to come forward and say like, oh, this terrible thing happened to me, when people would blame you for it. But like in the Victorian time, that was, you had to be very, very strong to do that, I think. So that's why they were scared of her. Yeah.
What did she accuse Jane of doing to her?
So she didn't actually accuse her of anything, because, I mean, it's sort of like what we were seeing and are seeing now. You can't unsay something. Like if you accuse someone, you have to really double down on it and be ready to go all in. So she didn't do that until much later, when other people, or really when the detectives arrested her much later, after the entire Davis family died. And then she came forward and she was like, oh yeah, she was my nurse and this crazy thing happened. But basically what happened is she came into the hospital for an ulcer to be removed on her uterus. And she was understandably in a lot of pain. And Jane, and this was kind of her MO, she administered morphine, which we still even use now, right, for extreme pain. But what Jane would do is overdose her patients on morphine and get them very close to death. And then she would bring them back, or try to bring them back, with atropine. So it was a very morbid and disgusting scientific experiment on people who, I mean, it was torture. She tortured them, basically, or actually she tortured them. And she tricked a lot of the doctors, because, you know, they would have seizures or stroke or heart failure, and the doctors would come in, and the side effects for morphine and atropine are opposite. So they couldn't tell what had happened to the patient. And that's essentially what happened to Amelia Finney. So she got, Jane gave her something to drink, which is part of her MO. She would put it in mineral water, because mineral water is bitter. So it would disguise the effect of, or not disguise the effect, the disguise the taste of atropine and morphine. And it wasn't always orally administered. Sometimes she would inject them if they were already unconscious, et cetera. Or enemas is what she did later on, which is even more disturbing. But then she would observe the effects of the morphine and the atropine, and how they interacted with one another as the patient was going in and out of consciousness, and document it. And Amelia Finney kind of realized what was happening, and she was like, no, I'm not going to take any more medicine. And she remembered Jane getting into bed with her. And like laying there with her and molesting her while she couldn't move because she was overdosed. So that's what Amelia Finney testified. And that's essentially because she was one of the only surviving victims, even though they had plenty of evidence that she was killing people. That's one of the main things that, like, the testimonies that sealed her the verdict against her.
So when we come back from this quick break, Jane begins to kill.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Some of us love history. Others used to or never did because history was presented as nothing but the rote memorization of names, dates, and facts. Basically, the story got left out, and that made history kind of suck. My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a university professor with a PhD in history, and bringing history to life is my passion. That's why I created my podcast, History That Doesn't Suck. I want to teach you everything you need to know about U.S. history, but I do so through stories. Let me tell you about George Washington begging his men not to mutiny against Congress, Clara Barton saving Union soldiers amid enemy fire, enslaved Frederick Douglass risking his life for liberty, and about so many other figures as their real experiences make industrialization, social movements, and even congressional debates and tax policy come to life. Subscribe to History That Doesn't Suck today, and join me, Professor Greg Jackson, every other week for a new episode, where I'd like to tell you a story.
And we are back. So do you believe that Jane's experience in the hospital, the things she got away with, emboldened her, gave her courage to do even more extreme things?
I really do. I think that her behaviors escalated the more that she, like you said, got away with it. And just, you know, once she kind of mastered one, the natural thing to do is to move to the next step up. I mean, we see that in very positive ways too. Like yesterday I ran 1 mile, today I'm going to run 1.1 miles. You set kind of goals for yourself, as terrible as that sounds. But like we see with so many other killers who have murdered people on this scale, it starts off kind of small and then it, you know, the behaviors gradually become more and more risky. And by the end, she gets real sloppy. It's like, okay, well, all of these, this whole family died within a month, girl. What? How are you thinking you're going to get away with this? But to answer your question, yeah, I think the hospital definitely would have influenced that, because although these drugs were available over the counter, which is totally bananas to me, like you could get strychnine, chocolate covered strychnine over the counter. In these years, like I was looking, it's just doing research is so fun because you find things that you never would have thought to look at. Like when you go deep into the wormhole of like, okay, so this is where her confession was. And like next to it was an advertisement for strychnine.
Yeah.
And you can get morphine over the counter. And I'm not sure about atropine, but I do know that how to administer those drugs would have been in the realm of the medical expertise. So although they were more accessible, how to use them was probably something she learned in the hospital. Plus, I mean, if her philosophy was, well, this person's going to die soon anyway, I'm going to, you know, learn all I can from them. And so I think it seems like it cascaded almost into a from a mercy killing into an experiment into torture is what it seems like.
And you mentioned this element of possible sexual gratification as well.
Yes. So that is one of the most upsetting things, is that while Jane was experimenting on these people or her patients, and they would go into convulsions, she would get in the bed with them. And like you said, molest, or there was definitely that element of sexual gratification that was confirmed by Amelia Finney's testimony.
So what was her first documented murder? Who was the victim, and how did it happen?
So the first one is kind of dicey because she never really confessed to all of her murders, because I mean, like so many killers that we know, it's like, no, you figure it out. You figure out how smart I was. But also I think she kind of forgot / they may have died from other things caused by her torture. So the first one, I'm not confident about who that was, but I know they were her patients in, I believe, Cambridge Hospital. So the very first, I'm not sure, but it would have been one of her patients, and probably one that she liked a lot, because that she liked to keep them there if she liked them. So she'd make them sicker.
So once she leaves the hospital, things begin to escalate. Where does she go? What does she do?
So from the hospital, because she got dismissed without getting her nursing certificate from either one. So she went to school for much longer, but never actually got her certificate in hand. But she did have all of the recommendations from the doctors, and any administrator recommended her as well. From there, she went into the private nursing, and she tried a couple of other things and failed. For example, she wanted to manage basically the cafeteria at a seminary school nearby. The name is escaping me at the moment. But so she poisoned her friend, and when that woman died, she went to the person hiring and said, well, one of her last wishes was for me to take over her job. And then she did, and she was terrible at it because she'd never done anything like that before. So she tried that. She went back into private nursing. She also ran up huge debts, particularly when she would go spend her summers on Cape Cod at Buzzards Bay with the Davis family. They would let her stay there at a discounted rate because they liked her so much. And, you know, their other patrons felt really comfortable when having a medical professional on hand. But she ran up a huge debt there and was just like, oh yeah, I'll get you next time. And then never did. So that's where she went next. And she was known for like petty theft from her patients. But again, because it was a Victorian time, like no one would accuse her of that, especially because they were supposed to be grieving. And listeners, I don't know if y'all know this, but there was a whole death and funeral and grieving subculture in the Victorian time, which is just fascinating. Like the politics of a funeral at that time, like they would hire professional mourners. And a really fun book to read if you're into this. And I know I said fun, and well, y'all know what I mean. The Victorian Book of the Dead has like a bunch of interviews with undertakers at the time. And so it was just, it was gauche to be like, did you steal this from my mom, when it's, you know, it's not the thing to be worried about at the time. Yeah.
So during this time, she still maintains a relationship with her foster sister, right?
Yes. Or somewhat, right? Like it was somewhat fraught, but Elizabeth being, you know, older, but also somewhat childlike. And I don't mean that in a patronizing way, just like she was a fairly sheltered person. So she just kind of was like, I don't know why she's mad at me. I didn't do anything, which, I mean, she didn't really do anything to Jane. It was more of a circumstance thing that happened at Jane, but they corresponded, and Yeah, so Elizabeth was, and I don't know if this is about to be a spoiler, so skip it if you don't want to know.
Sure.
But she, Elizabeth was one of the victims, but one towards the end, once her method had gotten a little cleaner. So she invited Elizabeth to Cape Cod for during the summer because, I mean, I'm from the South. I'm sure that y'all can hear that in my voice. So it's always hot here, but in Massachusetts with this, or in Boston and the surrounding areas, at the time, apparently like the smog would keep the heat in. So everybody would leave over the summer. And Oramel, which is the best name I've ever heard and the only time I've ever heard it, Elizabeth's husband, was a depot master of the train. So he put her on a train out to Cape Cod, and they had a little summer cottage and they were having a nice time. And then Elizabeth starts getting sick, and the next morning, well, they call Oramel to come, and he does, and she dies like within 48 hours because of Jane. So they did have a relationship, and then Jane killed her. So that's the one where she says, like, it was the first person who I really was happy to watch them actually die and suffer. The other people, it was more of a removed scientific experiment, torture type of feeling for Jane. But in her confession, which if I'm sure, and no one has told, I mean, this can't be like corroborated by evidence, but it seems very editorialized, her confession. It just doesn't match up with like what she says, the way she says it doesn't match up with what she did. So I guess we can take that with a grain of salt, but it is a very harrowing line from her confession that where she's like, yeah, I watched with delight as she gasped out her life. Like, it's very upsetting. So yeah, it definitely feels like that's kind of what Jane crescendoed into, is killing Elizabeth.
So she suddenly discovered the joy of killing certain people anyway.
Yeah, I think that she realized that it wasn't just the torture that she enjoyed, but actually taking life as well. Like, she liked being in control of people living and dying. That's why she liked to push them to almost death and then bring them back, but also deliberately taking someone's life evidently gave her some kind of thrill or satisfaction, or both.
Yeah. You said earlier that her poisoning methods streamlined over time. What did you mean by that? How did she become more efficient?
So there's a couple of ways. She started with people who were already sick, for one, which doesn't really give you a control group, you know, because they already have things that they're being treated for or need to be treated. And then she graduated into overdosing someone and then giving them, it's not really an antidote, but an adjacent sort of combating poison, essentially. And her method of administration got more efficient as well. So she would do injections and not just dissolving a pill in mineral water. She also administered enemas that contained the same drugs or additional ones once the person was sick. So she could toy with someone who was poisoned, who she had poisoned for several days before ending their life. And that there, and in that comes a sort of meticulousness with the amount of medicine that they are given. And she got good at hiding it too. In the same way.
Wow. Ugh.
I know.
So yeah. Yeah. pretty despicable.
She's the worst.
So we obviously won't have time to get into the full details of every murder she committed. Mm-hmm. They are in your book, and readers can get the full details there. But I definitely want to ask you about the Davis family, if you don't mind.
Yes.
Can you share with us how she met the Davis family? How she was introduced to them?
Yes. So this is actually a really interesting sort of adjacent plot line. The Davises were a Southern family, from what I understand, or at least Alden Davis fought with the Confederacy in Louisiana, I believe. And then he came to Massachusetts and married a woman from there. And they opened a, not exactly a hotel, but like an Airbnb, a regular bed and breakfast. And the town did not very much like the Davises, not only because of the Civil War, you know, he fought with the South, which is bad, but also because they were part of a Christian offshoot group that it was essentially a cult. And one of the leaders, and Alden was a big member of this church. He's not the person that I'm about to tell a story about. Alden is the patriarch of the Davis family. But that family was a part of this essentially cult, religious sect, I guess we could say. And the leader of that group was hearing messages from directly from God, which we know now that's Old Testament God. That's not the way it happens anymore. If God is talking to you directly, it's most likely a psychological issue. That's not the way they looked at it, though. So when God told him that he needed to murder his youngest child and that she would be resurrected, he did it. And then he called everyone over to the house, all of his congregation, and was like, this is what God told me to do. So now we wait. And all of the congregation was like, no, that's not what we do. This is very bad. You killed your little girl. And Alden Davis was like, actually, no, if he heard the voice of God telling him to do that, I mean, that's what happened with Abraham. So the town basically ostracized the Davises for him backing this cult leader, understandably ostracized him, not understandably backing that behavior. So also just to kind of close that narrative out, the man who did murder his child was sent to an insane asylum, not the same one that Jane was sentenced to, which I thought would have been a really nice tight little bow, but that's not the way that real life works. So that's not the way it happened. But I mean, nobody really wanted to deal with the Davises because even though they were nice, like on a personal level, they were like, no, you can't, that's not an okay thing, that we're not okay with that. So they opened a hotel so that everyone from the city would come stay there in the summer, so because it was nicer. And that's how Jane came into contact with this family, is she also wanted to leave the city during the summer, and her patients would sometimes go there. And then she ended up renting a room from them, and I believe sometimes a whole cottage, but sometimes a room. And then they liked having her there so much that they were like, we'll give you a discount. And then that's when she ran up that huge debt. But another thing to consider is, like, when the matriarch Mattie Davis went to get the money back from Jane, that's when Jane poisoned her. And then she came back to the Davis home to take care of the rest of the family in her absence, and then just picked them off one by one, which is also very upsetting. And that's when the detectives were finally like, I think these are not coincidences, because they all died in such close succession and from similar symptoms. They didn't diagnose them the same way, but the symptoms were similar.
When we come back from a brief break, Jane Toppin finally gets caught.
Let Mysteries at Midnight be your destination for detective whodunits and captivating mystery stories. You'll hear classic stories like Sherlock Holmes, Agatha Christie's Poirot, and short tales from H.G. Wells, Charles Dickens, Edgar Allan Poe, and others. I'm Christopher, and I read these classic stories in the soothing style of a bedtime story, so you can listen to them in bed when you drift off to sleep. I also host the number one sleep podcast in the world called Sleep Cove, where millions drift off to meditations, hypnosis, and bedtime stories. We soon realized that listeners wanted to hear our mystery stories all in one place, So we created Mysteries at Midnight, where you can listen to all new tales every week. Search for Mysteries at Midnight on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app, and follow and subscribe so you don't miss out on new episodes. So why don't you pick a story now? And can you guess the twist?
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore all of the weird little questions and conspiracies of the universe in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything. Everything has an explanation.
We hope.
But that is what we're here to figure out. We will dive into the science behind many popular conspiracy theories, such as vaccines causing autism, flat earth theory, and was the moon landing fake? And if so, why the heck would anyone even do that?
But it's not just conspiracies. There's a lot of cool mysteries that we will attempt to use science to explain, such as near-death experiences, what made the Vikings go berserk, and can I control my co-host with MK Ultra?
Wait, what? Anyway, make sure to check out the Mystery of Everything podcast everywhere where you find your podcasts.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course, you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
Back again. Was Jane using strychnine at this point?
So strychnine wasn't necessarily, her kind of cocktail of choice. She typically used morphine and atropine. Sometimes she'd throw some strychnine in there just for, you know, to change it up, I guess. But yes, that is how she, it was a consistent MO. One of the daughters, the Davis daughters who died, her father-in-law, one of the reporters who came to interview him told him it was strychnine, and he was like, that doesn't sound right. I mean, she is too smart to get caught using something like that. I always thought it, I mean, like, I, based on what I've read in the papers, I thought it would be morphine and atropine. And the reporter was like, holy shit, that's exactly right. Let me go take this back to the, the people who are like the medical examiners. And that was just his intuition. Like, he was just a grizzled old sea captain who had been around and seen some stuff, and he was like, that doesn't sound right to me. And he told them that what was exactly the case, which honestly, like, he was one of my favorite characters to write, because I just got the sense that he was so tired of people not having good sense that it was, I don't know, I just really enjoyed that character and that chapter and writing it. Also, it was a big relief to write with a person who is like fundamentally good at the center of it. It's not nearly as emotionally taxing, I'm sure you know too.
Oh, it's great to have a heroic character to write about amidst all of the carnage, right?
Truly, yes. I can remember, like, I'll go out with my friends and they'd be like, what's wrong? And I'll be like, well, I just killed four people. Like, I don't feel great. of course I didn't, but, you know, writing about it, having to get down in there is sort of like dreaming that you accidentally hit a puppy in your car or something. Like, you didn't do it, but it feels like you just feel bad about it later, you know?
Yeah. It can get heavy sometimes.
Yeah.
Even just doing this podcast, I'm constantly reading and talking about murder and death.
Yeah,
I get it. So she was arrested. How did she react to her arrest, to her interrogation? Did she remain cool? She didn't confess right away.
No, she didn't confess until I think after she was convicted. Guilty but insane, which is wild.
Right.
But so she was staying with a couple of her friends when the detective showed up and were like, we're arresting you. And I think she was allowed to pack a bag and change clothes. And she was upset that the detectives wouldn't give her any privacy to change clothes. And they were like, obviously, lady, like, we're not going to just be like, yeah, go ahead into the back of the house. Like, no, get your things. Let's go. But she maintained her innocence throughout until she was convicted. And she actually had a lot of letters of support from her former patients and employers saying that they knew that there was no way she could have done anything that they were accusing her of. And I think hiding behind that, she kind of believed her own lies for a while of like, I didn't do it. And then whenever she was convicted, guilty but insane and sentenced to, or I'm not even sentenced, but like committed to an insane asylum. I mean, according to the newspapers, which of course we take with a grain of salt based on the newspapers that this came from, she was happy about it because she was like, well, I'm not crazy. I knew what I was doing. Like, I knew I was killing those people. It's not like I didn't know. Like, I'm not crazy, which is even more disturbing than her being like, no, I did. I have no idea what I've done. She definitely knew what she was doing. Yeah. And so I guess you could say that she was kind of cool about it because that's the level of narcissism that we were working with.
Right. She'd gotten away with it for so long that she felt invincible, right?
Yeah, I think so. Especially when, you know, you have a lawyer coming to a friend from your childhood who believes in your innocence so strongly that he'll defend you for free. Like, that's how confident that he was. And that's how believable she was. She was very charismatic. Jolly, they said.
So the trial took place in November of 1901, right?
I believe so, yes.
How long did the trial last, and were there any surprises?
So the court records were actually kind of hard to find. I did find them. I went to Massachusetts. I can't remember which library it was. It was gorgeous. Everything in Massachusetts, the architecture is just amazing. But I went there, and I was like, hey, I need the court proceedings from this case. And the woman working there was like, I don't think we have that. That's way older than we keep. And I was like, I'm from Georgia. I need you to look really hard. Like, I flew up here for this specifically. Cause you know, when it's like historical records, they can't send it out. Of course not. Like, what if it got lost? They can't photocopy it cause it could get damaged. So she found it, and it was pretty short. Like, it didn't have all of the courtroom procedural drama that I think of. Like, it wasn't like A Time to Kill where you have like word for word everything everyone said, which would have been very satisfying to read. And I wish, of course, that we did have that. But one thing that surprised me is the day that I was looking at it was the day that one of the testimonies happened. And I was like, okay, I know that this is just a coincidence, but I hate it. Like, it's the same day. So that was terrible. But I think the biggest surprise in hearing about it was from the matron who ran the prison. The women's prison was just like a one cell, and this wasn't in that document, but she talked about how she was always very courteous. That Jane was always very courteous to her, and she had people send her flowers and. It was just really hard to reconcile that was the same person. Like, that was very unnerving to me. Like, the woman who takes care of the prison also does not want to believe that person is capable of doing something that monstrous. And I mean, I get it. Like, we see people who we feel are good people even now. You know, accused of horrible things, and you kind of have to believe it but also you don't want to. Like, but they're so nice. Like, they've done so much good. Like, you, how can that both things be true? But they can. So that was probably one of the most unnerving. And then how all the whole town kind of turned out to hear the verdict on the courthouse steps. That was interesting.
Who was she tried for killing? Which of her victims?
The Davises is the one that they, and I think it was one of the daughters, but because she was in great health. It wasn't Genevieve. It was the other one.
How did period newspapers portray her? Was she looked at as a monster?
Yes, once they realized she had done it. Up until then, they kind of depicted her as like matronly and fun to be around and not really a threat, because like they kind of body shamed her even for the Victorian time. We talked about how much weight she had gained and stuff. But she was also like very attractive. Like, people liked being around her. So partly that, and then once she was arraigned, they really just focused on the details of like what fabric her dress was, and that she wore a high collar, which is very like red carpet sounding, right? Like, what is she wearing to her trial? Like, that makes all the difference, which I just, that's so interesting to me that is still a thing, like so many years later. And then, of course, like in her confession, which I believe has been influenced by not just her, it's definitely like she talks in such a ruthless way that it's hard to believe, even if you want to believe it, that she would say it like that.
What was the confession?
Just the things that she said about the terrible true confession of Jane Toppin. It's actually, if y'all have the hardcover book, it's part of the cover, and it's also like the front matter, like the white pages that would be white, is like part of that actual document, which is super dope. And I'm really happy with that design. But it's her terrible true confession. And she says things that are, it's very like Bond villainy, where it's like, and here was my whole evil plan, that it just doesn't seem like she would say, even if it was true. And even if she felt like that, like, for example, probably if I had gotten married and had children, then I wouldn't have killed all those people. Like, that just seems very like, where do we, what? Like, that doesn't make any sense. Which, I mean, that very well could have been the case, but it seems like it would have cropped up somewhere before 35 deaths. But just things like that, that are just kind of incongruous.
She claims she was jilted by a lover or a potential lover earlier in her life, and that's what turned her bad. Was that basically, in essence, what she was saying?
I think that is what she blamed it on, but I don't know that that's the whole truth, and I don't think that she would have known either. She was jilted at the she was engaged, and then that man like married someone else suddenly. So that can't have felt good, of course, especially because she was of working class and he wasn't. He was a little bit more affluent than she was. But yeah, so that's kind of what she blamed it on. Like, she would have said, like, I wouldn't have had time to do it if I had been married and had children. Which I guess that's kind of true, but also no, that's sort of like blaming your bad behavior on something else. And I feel like with, like I said, or kind of said a minute ago, as narcissistic as she was, it just seems like she wouldn't have passed the buck onto something that she couldn't control, because she was so all about control.
Right, right.
Yeah,
for sure. Speaking of relationships, after she killed her foster sister Elizabeth, didn't she scheme to get together with Elizabeth's widowed husband?
Yes, which is atrocious and just in life should not happen. But yeah, she did. And I don't even think it was so much about him, because to hear her describe him, he was like not her speed really. But he had all of the Toppin stuff. Like, all of the stuff ended up going to him, because it went first to Elizabeth, and then she died, and then he had, you know, all of her inheritance. So it seemed like that, and then also a way to twist the knife posthumously in Elizabeth. Metaphorically, she did not stab her. But yeah, she did try to seduce him. She made him sick and then tried to seduce him and then tried to blackmail him by saying she was pregnant. And he was like, that's literally impossible on many levels. And so then she, when that didn't work, it was kind of her last ditch effort. And then she tried and failed twice to complete suicide, which is super devastating. But yeah, he was like, get out of my house. He was having none of it once he realized that. And he wasn't going to throw stones, so to speak, but could have and probably should have. And probably if he had, would have saved several other lives. If just anyone had spoken up about it. And that's, you know, honestly, that's kind of what the big takeaway from writing this book was for me, is like, early intervention is so important. Like if you see something going awry in someone's childhood, you know, it takes a village to raise a person, and we're all somewhat culpable for people around us. Like if you can help, you should help. That's just how we should live. And at any step in this horrific journey, if someone had just said, hey, so this happened, it did happen, I will do it, I will say it on the stand under oath, I think that things could have turned out very differently for a lot of people. And of course, not to blame the victims, like that's very, very difficult to do, as we talked about before. But that's the biggest takeaway, is like, what is the bystander effect of like, everyone thinks someone else is going to call in the gunshot, is it's very real.
Like the Kitty Genovese case.
Yeah. I mean, that happens all the time with things like you pass a wreck on the freeway, right? And someone else has probably already called it in, so you don't bother. That happens on such a small scale as well. I don't think that that Jane had to end up like this. I think it was that she made a choice, and that her surroundings let her make that choice, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does.
Okay, good. Because I was like, I'm not trying to absolve her of the guilt, but I think we can all take some responsibility. And like, if you see something weird, tell someone about it. Tell someone about it who can potentially help, even if you can't personally.
So she was required to face a panel of psychiatrists, alienists. What did they ultimately conclude about her mental state?
So as far as the process went, I think that, I mean, we know now we're learning so much about mental health just on a regular basis, even now, that they didn't know nearly as much as we know now about why people do the things they do, how to prevent them, that something that happened in your childhood can affect you well into your adulthood. So I think they were essentially examining her daily behaviors, which looked on the outside fairly normal according to the matron at the prison, right? Like she, you know, wanted to make her dress, which was in needlework and needlepoint at the time, was a very accepted pastime for women. She liked having attention. She liked talking to people. She liked telling stories. And I think that from what I remember of reading the historical documents, that the more they observed, the more they noticed that she was just making stuff up all the time about like who she had talked to recently. And I'm going a lot of off of memory here, so I could be wrong about some of this, but yeah, it's like she believed the lies that she was telling. Like they saw it not happen, and she was telling them that it had, with total confidence that she was telling the truth. So I think that's why they ruled her guilty but insane, and why they stuck to that verdict, conviction.
So Jane Toppin believed that once she was committed to an asylum, she would be able to convince people there, charm them into believing that she was sane, and then they would release her back into society.
Yes. When she got the sentencing that she was going to an asylum, she was like, oh, I'll be out here in no time. Like, I'm not crazy. I have been holding down a job. Like, I'm fine. They will see that I am normal. And this part is actually pretty sad for her. even though she is a monster, it is also sad because she was one of the best behaved patients, and she often helped or wanted to help the nurses at the asylum do their job because she was a nurse. So they all liked her, and then she gradually disintegrated into dementia later in her life, where she would have the outbursts for reasons that people couldn't tell, insisted that people call her Honora, which she had not gone by since childhood. When she first got there, she was like, yeah, I'm going to be out of here in a couple months. This is nothing, like, joke's on you type of thing.
And it ended up being over 30 years.
Yeah. She lived well into old age at the time. I want to say she passed in the mid-1930s. So she was in that asylum as long as her adult life beforehand, pretty much about the same amount of time.
So I want to ask you about the way you chose to write your book.
Okay.
It's not written in a traditional nonfiction style. Mm-hmm. Would you share why you chose to write your book the way you did?
Oh, yeah. That's a fun question. So I actually, before I decided to write this book, I wanted to read it. So when I heard the story on that podcast, I tried to find a book that was written the way that I wanted to write it. Or that I wanted to read it. And I found Harold Schechter's book, Fatal. And I read it and I was like, oh, this is lots of information about her, but it doesn't really have the causal nature that I like in a narrative. So I'm gonna write that. And as I was researching and outlining the book, I came to the realization that Jane really never does have very much of a voice. And we can't really know, even if she told us, which she kind of does, why she did the things that she did, because she's not trustworthy either. And I thought that was the, like, portraying her story through multiple points of view was the most authentic way to tell the truth about her, because that's really all that we have evidence of is other people's observations of her. There is one chapter from her perspective, which was probably the hardest one to write because not only because of what we talked about before, which is like, it gets real heavy to think about someone that depraved for that long, but also because hurt people hurt people. You know, like we heard that cliche so many times because it's true. Like she was definitely a monster for sure. I'm not trying to say that she wasn't, and I'm not trying to absolve her of any of the things that she's done, but she was also a hurt person. And so, I don't know, she just kind of puts all of her responsibility into the fact that she was wronged. And it's not fair to anyone to do that. But that's, I guess, in a nutshell, why I chose to write it this way, because it felt like the most authentic. And I felt like I could get the most accurate truthiness of the story in the book that way. Yeah, and sometimes when I couldn't write it better than it was already written, we used and credited the whole newspaper article that it originally came from, because I couldn't do it any better than what it was already written as.
Yeah. So tell us about your podcast. Tell us about your website and how people can buy your book.
Okay. So first thing you asked about is the podcast. I co-host it with two of my best friends. One of them works in elder care, and the other used to work with me in mental health. And I also am a professor, but used to teach English. And so we have all the different perspectives on horror movies, where we both analyze them and make fun of them, kind of like we were saying about, like, nobody thinks it's really funny, but we get the joke, so we're all in it together. The podcast is called Everything Trying to Kill You. And we talk about all different horror movies from all across time. We just did an episode on Jurassic Park, which is technically not horror, but I blame it a lot on the soundtrack. Why it's not horror, because it is a creature feature, if you think about it.
Right.
And then we're doing, like, Horse Girl. We've done The Exorcist. So we really run the gamut of horror movies. And that's really fun for us.
Sure.
So that's one thing. I also have an author website. I do some freelance writing about horror movies and some essays, some nonfiction. I soon have one coming out with narratively about the woman named Solitude, who led a slave rebellion in Guadeloupe when she was 8 months pregnant. So I'm real excited for that one. And I also, as you know, if you've made it this far in the podcast, wrote a book called America's First Female Serial Killer, Jane Taupin and the Making of a Monster. And you can buy that anywhere you like to buy books. I like to recommend that you buy it at your local independent bookstore because that helps the most people. But everywhere has it. If you love Amazon or you just need it immediately, you can get it on Amazon. You can get it on Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. And hopefully, and this is amazing, like if you go into your independent bookstore nearby or online, if they're doing that, they can get it for you if they don't have it. And that might also lead other people to it, which I would love. And then, of course, you have the bookshop online as well. And that's America's First Female Serial Killer. And I'm Mary Kay. And I had a great time talking about this book with you, Eric. Thank you so much.
Yeah. No, it was fun. Well, thanks again. Very enlightening. I really appreciate it.
I'm really glad that we got in touch and made a connection, and I'm excited to share this with the world. So thank you so much.
Again, I have been speaking to Mary Kay McBrayer. Her book is called America's First Female Serial Killer, Jane Taupin and the Making of a Monster. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.
Have you ever wondered how inbred the Habsburgs really were? What women in the past used for birth control? Or what Queen Victoria's 9 children got up to? On the History Tea Time podcast, I profile remarkable queens and LGBTQ+ royals, explore royal family trees, and delve into women's medical history and other fascinating topics. Join me every Tuesday for History Tea Time, wherever fine podcasts are enjoyed.
Hello, my name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.